I am using AI a lot in terms of market research. My process for, you know, previously having worked with clients in terms of their marketing is I would go and find things on Reddit about their market, about their customer. I would go down like a Reddit, so massive deep dive research. I would go scour the internet for information about the company, about the customer's needs. The research component used to take me days, if not weeks, to do per customer. Whereas the AI thing has made research just such an easy thing to do. Like, it just made it an absolute breeze. Rather than going through and trying to figure this information out myself, I can ask ChatGPT or Claude and say, hey, here's my customer. Here's their website. Here's who I think their customers are. Give me a list of 20 or 50 articles or, you know, websites that's going to give me everything I need to understand what their customers go through.
Hello, I'm Jeremy Rivera, your Unscripted podcast host. I'm here with William Wang of Black Belt Consulting. I'm curious about your life experience that has brought you to this point and what inspired you to combine these disparate elements and bring them into the marketing that you're doing right now.
Yeah. So first and foremost, thanks for having me, Jeremy. It's great to be here and, you know, have a chat about, things in life. So I guess a quick summary of my life experiences was that, grew up here in Sydney, Australia, in probably one of the worst suburbs around. So I grew up kind of, that kind of typical immigrant spring where we didn't really have much, but, you know, it was still a pretty good life. Parents wanted me to follow the very safe path of, you know, becoming either a doctor, engineer, or something like that. I was not smart enough to do that. So I defaulted to the path of going to corporate IT. So the reason why I went to corporate IT was because my dad was in IT and I just figured, look, this is just going to be an easy path. He can help me with assignments, things like that. But I kind of wandered around for a long while, went into just a default job. I became a business data analyst, which kind of means I was just staring at spreadsheets from, 8 to 6 every single day and just hated my life. The challenge with that is that I was on a pretty good salary. So as someone who was, 27, 28, I was making 130, 150K a year, but I really wanted to, I've always dreamt of going out on my own. But when you've got that salary and, by that time I was married and my wife had my second child, I was like, hey, if I don't do this now, then it's never going to get done. But how do you replace $130,000 a year salary, right? Like that's pretty difficult. So what ended up happening was I tried all this other stuff. I tried like e-commerce, I tried affiliate marketing, but it's really hard to hit that level in terms of revenue by selling a $20 or $30 widget where you've got a 10 or 20% margin on it. So I ended up looking at a few things and, copywriting and consulting and actually doing marketing for people ended up being this thing that you can charge $2,000 or $3,000 a month for. And at that time, I figured, look, if I can just get 3 or 4 clients per month, make $12,000 to $15,000 per month, I'm sorted. Like, I'm sweet. I can work from home. I don't have to go on the bus every morning to go to work. Like, life's okay. So, long story short, in the business side of things, I stumbled my way around for about 2 years. It took me about 2 years to hit that mark properly. And during that time, I made every mistake in business. Super introverted, so I didn't like the selling. I didn't like the marketing of it. So it kind of was like this move that in hindsight, if I'd known how difficult or what I needed to do to get to the point, I don't know if I would have done it. But long story short, 2.5 year journey to hit that point, and then from that point on, I made every single mistake to the point where I couldn't make any more mistakes, and then the business kind of took off. And I always say I accidentally built my previous business into a 7-figure business without really meaning to. It was just like the growth happened, and we just had to keep growing to keep chasing revenue. At a certain point, I started to figure things out to enjoy business, and that's when things happened. And then last point of that story is I sold that business about 12 months ago. And then, I've been training Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu the whole way through and got my black belt maybe 3 or 4 years ago. And so when I was thinking about this new business, it's like, well, what do we do? I still love marketing. I still want to consult, but let's bring some of the personal branding elements into it. And so that was kind of the birth of Black Belt Consulting.
That I started my own karate adventure in the past 4 months and just graduated to yellow belt. Nice. So definitely feel, something in myself. A lot of your points echo some of the things that I've been through myself of, being in a corporate job. I worked for homes.com, and just, was stuck in this corporate nightmare where they thought a 2% annual raise was generous and would fight with employees over like $150 bonus. And it's just a soul crushing experience. I'm like, I got to do something else. I have to learn something else. And fortunately, the skill that I was learning, SEO, opened up doors, and then ended up working for a really good software company for a little while, doing SaaS and learning product marketing myself. So I definitely feel you on that side of making all of the possible mistakes of, because at that point, I kind of tried to launch my own, freelancing. I've done, all of the different various versions. I've worked in-house. I've worked for a good agency. I've worked for a bad agency. Had a successful stint as a freelancer, an unsuccessful stint as freelancer, and everything in between. So, what has been your journey like working with a team? And what are those soft skills that you've had to learn over the years to make things happen, and not just, or maybe I'm putting words into your mouth, but is there something to those soft skills of being able to work together, put together teams and functions versus just doing the solopreneur thing? I'm just the entire thing carrying this.
That's a really good question. So, I mean, I'll give you some context into it. When I first started the business, my first business, I didn't think anything of. Like, I just thought, I could easily do it myself and get to 12, 15K a month. And I very quickly figured out it was really difficult to, like, there's so many small things as an entrepreneur and a business owner you have to look at, right? There's like invoicing, chasing invoices, paying the taxes, doing all the million little scheduling appointments, like the million little things that it's really nice to get help for. In my current business and in the businesses I'm about to acquire, I'm looking at teams as an AI enabled. So I think the teams thing has really changed. So there's obviously, and I'm kind of rambling here, but there's obviously a lot of soft skills you have to have with a team. But in having grown a seven-figure business, I realized that I like having a very small core team of highly competent people. People who you don't necessarily have to micromanage or have a look at what they're doing every single day of the week. I'd rather have competent people who know how to get the job done, and who are A players. So that's one thing that I've realized, right? Well, my team in my last business, we had about 20 people at our peak, or about 25 at our peak, and it just got a little bit too much. Like, it's just, at 25 people, we needed about three levels of management. And because most of my team were about 90% of my team were virtual. We had about four or five locally here in Australia, and then we had about 20 in the Philippines. But to manage a virtual workforce, it's really difficult. Like, you can't turn around and ask somebody a question. It's easy to get distracted by tasks that, and you go into this massive rabbit hole where team members have spent a day working on something. I'll turn around and we're like, that wasn't what we wanted to work on at all. So it's kind of, very difficult to manage in that term. Soft skills, obviously, you have to learn about how can I inspire people, how can I lead people. But I also think in this day and age, the way that I'm going to build new businesses is really just, give people a goal, give people a vision, and then hire people who are competent and disciplined enough to do what they need to do.
I think that's sometimes one of the harder things is figuring out where to let go of the back of the bike. As a father, I've got a 7-year-old and a 12-year-old, and there's that moment where you're running alongside and holding the back of the bike, and you've set up everything in motion, and if you don't let go, it's not going to work. But it does take that test of faith of, I've got this, let's go. Let's can I, so definitely a vetting process. What are some of the ways that you've been, finding talent or skill that kind of meets those criteria? Because obviously, we're not in a day and age where I need a PhD to help me start my new business. You might not even necessarily be looking for somebody who has a 4-year degree, or might even accept somebody with an associate's. Or how do you go about finding the talent that fits, that's right sized for your need?
I tend to start at the role that we actually need. So then the way that I've hired and I'm hiring in future is I'll look at their role and go, is this a role that needs a lot of creativity? Is this a role that needs a lot of thinking experience? Do they have to have done this before, or is this something that we can teach, right? So is this an issue of we haven't done this role before, we need the experience, or is this an issue of we don't have capacity to do something within the team, but we have the SOPs and the processes in place where somebody can come in and easily learn the role? If it's a role where I need more experience, I need to give the burden of responsibility to that person. Generally speaking, I will in future hire that locally to me. So I will look at things like, you know, go to LinkedIn jobs or try and poach off bigger companies. So I'll message people on LinkedIn who are in the roles that I want to hire for. That's how I go to hire those roles. If it's more of a role where, you know, we have the processes, it's more of a junior role. There's not as much independent thinking required. Typically, I will try and source that role from the Philippines or, you know, some kind of some other country where it can be done virtually, right? Just because the cost arbitrage is actually quite a good play. So if that's the play, then I look at sites like onlinejobs.ph is probably my favorite. Upwork is great as well. I mean, just understand that, you know, you don't necessarily need to hire somebody who's full-time. You can just get contractors or freelancers who are very, very good, but they don't have to sit with you or sit next to you in an office.
I think there's definitely that component of making those workflow decisions that is a lot easier when you have a defined SOP. And that's an acronym, you know, standard operating procedures that as a freelancer, I was kind of totally opposed to that personally, because I viewed, you know, myself as a solopreneur, you know, SEO consultant. I'm going to do this boutique each time. And, you know, each business is unique and I want to treat it, you know, and I kept figuring out that, oh, you know what? I keep doing the same thing again and again. So maybe then, okay, fine, I'll bite the bullet and I'll make a template for my SEO audit process. And actually, there was an incredible amount of freedom in that, because then I wasn't reinventing the wheel every single time before I put it on the bike to drive it, you know, to ride it somewhere. So what's been your experience with documentation, with SOPs, with setting up structures for success to be able to, you know, hit criteria or goals in your...
Yeah. So previously, and with my current business, I'll speak about my previous business, because that's the one that I actually had to implement a whole bunch of SOPs and things like that for. Whereas consulting at the moment is kind of a bit more freedom based. Like, you know, we obviously tailor the structure depending on the clients that we're working with. But in the agency that I was running before, in the very early days, what I would do is I would go and just shoot Loom videos of me doing a task. So something simple, like, for example, here's how we onboard a client. Here's how we invoice a client. I just go and record a Loom video. I'd hit record and say, hey, here's what I'm doing now. And I just go through and type it. And then I send a Loom video to my operations person, who wasn't my operations person at the time. She was just a virtual assistant. But, you know, through time and through working with me for about 8 or 10 years, she became my director of ops, just because she was just amazing at what she actually did. But she just take the Loom video and go through and follow the same process. And she would be the one who creates SOP documents, because she's the one taking screenshots as she's going through. So that was my kind of cheat or kind of hack to do it. I don't have the patience. I'm not a very operations or detailed person in terms of admin the operation. So I probably wasn't the right person to do the ops. So if you know, if you're the same way, if you like, I'm very much the big picture creative, the copywriter, and I like to just sit here and just write things down on paper. Whereas, like, you know, pushing the buttons, things like that, somebody else is generally better than me on my team. So they were the ones who created it. But obviously I'm the one, you know, if you can't create an SOP if you don't understand what you're trying to do. But it's also hard to create an SOP if you're not detail orientated in the operation side. It's probably better to have that mix of, you know, do it once, do it a couple of times, but have somebody else watch you and document you to create the SOP.
I'm curious what your experience has been so far with leveraging AI and LLM-based technology. Because I see that as like two sides to the same coin. There's how you leverage it internally for ops and managing things, executing internally and supporting your marketing process. And then there's the flip side of Michael McDougall, my friend, calls it your least trained customer support representative. So I feel like there's two conversations to have. So let's talk on the one side in terms of like operations, in terms of marketing, effectiveness. What are the upsides and downsides to the tools that have been rolling out to professionals like us?
Yeah, really good question. And I think it's something that's on everybody's mind at the moment, right? Like it's a hot topic. In terms of operations, it's funny because I think operationally, the way that we're using AI is we don't use it a heck of a lot, but most of the software pieces that we do use, for example, a billing or Stripe or things like that, they're starting to build AI into it. And so I think the AI component of those is more just for like reporting and finding trends, things like that. I am using AI a lot in terms of market research. My process for, previously having worked with clients in terms of their marketing is I would go and find things on Reddit about their market, about their customer. I would go down like a Reddit just a massive deep dive research. I'll look at association websites. I'll go scour the internet for information about the company, about the customer's needs. And the research component used to take me days, if not weeks, to do per customer. Whereas the AI thing has made research just such an easy thing to do. Like it just made it an absolute breeze, right? So rather than going through and trying to figure this information out myself, I can ask ChatGPT or Claude and say, hey, here's my customer. Here's their website. Here's who I think their customers are. Give me a list of 20 or 50 articles or websites that's going to give me everything I need to understand what their customers go through. And so obviously within marketing, what I really need to understand is what are the pains, frustrations, challenges and goals that the end user has, right? Because they're the ones who are going to buy the products. AI can come through and create this picture for me of, hey, your end customer is Mary. She's 32. She's married. When she wakes up in the morning, her husband's already up. He's getting ready for work. She's got work as well, but she's also got to get the kids ready for school. Alarm's gone off, she's tired, but she has to drag herself out of it. Like it just gives you this amazing story from the perspective of the customer. And before, I was the one who had to go and create that story, or I was the one who had to go and create and look at, comments on websites and, look at what people are saying. But now that's kind of getting delivered in a matter of minutes rather than days or weeks. So obviously that being said though, with AI, there's just so much BS that's out. Like it hallucinates so much stuff all the time. So you've got to be very, very careful. And so the standard rule I've got at the moment is nothing that we do that gets delivered to clients or that we tell clients to deliver for themselves, none of that is actually AI done. So the output is still very, hands-on human, but the research piece, the stuff that, that used to take us a lot longer, that can be AI assisted essentially.
I like that mentality because I see that too. Even with, I'm going to be transforming our dialogue here afterwards and handing over, a version of it. And I have to be like very conscientious and scan through because I've generated some in the past and has invented parts of the conversation and then asked, did you make that up? No. Are you sure? Oh, yes, you're right. I'm sorry. There was a comic that I saw of like this magician that was had a ChatGPT bird that was said, oh, the spell is this. And they set themselves on fire. Like, that wasn't the right spelling. I'm so sorry. You're right. That was this set yourself on fire spell. There's this moment here where it's kind of like figuring out the downside of having an eternal yes man created this digital assistant with its default as deference. It lives to please, and it's going to use math to make up something, and that something might be mostly true, or it might be partly fictional. Like that's a strange moment for us to have kind of this beta test technology, right? Like if they tried to roll out this level of AI, in 2012. It would have been just utter, like these companies would have been shut down for malpractice of releasing these models into the wild with such a huge error rate. Like you are getting, Google out there saying, adding gasoline to kitchen recipes, like really obvious mistakes that in the quality controls of just 10 years ago would have been impossible to sustain. What do you think it is about where we're at and technology that's, letting us slide so much on something like AI hallucination.
That's such a great question. I don't know. I mean, it could be partly human nature, right? Like, I feel like as things get easier, people just expect things to get done faster and with less effort. I feel like that could be part of it. And everybody just wants something done quickly. Like, nobody wants to, and obviously generalizing very much, right? But, there's less people who are willing to go and put in the hard yards or, and this is going to sound like complaining, but a lot of the people that I start interviewing or that I'm interviewing for roles, they'll come out of university or like college and just expect $100,000 a year with very limited experience or, not having put the time and effort in. And I feel like, and it's not just, people who have young people, obviously there's other people I've interviewed who aren't as young, but for some reason still expect a lot more than what the role's going for or, what actually matches in my mind what salaries or things like that. So I think it's just maybe, yeah, it's a big question then. It's a big answer. Maybe it's just the fact that people expect a lot for very little these days, or they just want speed and ease, and they're just used to having things being super easy, super fast. And so it's a matter of like, well, yes, I can spend weeks getting this 100% right, or if an AI model can give me the answer, and it's sometimes right, sometimes yes, 50-50 or like 60% right, I'll rather have the answer now in a matter of minutes rather than having to put the time and the effort and the research in it, and it might take me weeks. So potentially that could be it. Yeah, I mean, love to get your thoughts because it's actually such a good question, and I just don't know the answer.
I think I was reading an article that Matt Diggity pushed on LinkedIn, and it was sourcing from a recent Google research, which was pointing out that search behavior has changed, and that actually the num that AI overviews tend to actually increase the number of queries that people are putting in to discover the same information. And it was kind of counterintuitive because from my own marketing perspective, we're seeing kind of a shrinking of the number of clicks that we're getting through to our sites. But the research from Google is pointing out that there's actually more people that, when they want to learn about Taekwondo, they're not researching and pulling up a site. Instead, they're pulling up YouTube videos. And if they're wanting to find out more about, the current trends of SEO, they're not reading as many blog posts, but they're trying to find active forums, or they're trying to find the right subreddit where the discussion is going on, or a Slack channel or a community. And so the search behavior has become almost more shallow in certain ways, broader. People are expecting, more faster. So it's like that easiness thing that you're talking about of like more, better, faster results. But they were pointing out that it also, with less pressure, there tends to be more questions that get asked to solve the same, question, which, like that's its own, snake eating its own tail situation of like, okay, well, Google just admitted that its results are crap and that people have to do multiple searches, breaking down more specific and more specific questions to try to get even closer to an answer because search is kind of breaking in certain ways. But at the same time, there's also, a lot more specificity in, the queries that people are putting in. It's not, oh, I need a wall in my backyard. It's, oh, tell me the value and benefit of getting a precast concrete wall, versus getting installed, a chain link fence or a wood fence. Those type of deeper comparative things, used to be something that where, the expected search behavior was you'd find an article, you'd go deep into it, and then it might have most of the answer there. But now there's kind of this like multimodal, unlocking nodes, this query fan out model that, Mike King and others in the SEO industry are talking about of, how LLMs are stacking queries to build the answers to it. But that means that people are more likely to run down those thought chains. which, you know, that's a positive and a negative, you know, and as we flip over from that conversation of how we use AI on to execute on the business, it comes to how are we fronting, you know, confronting this robot sandwich situation. You know, there's this conundrum this of, hey, you need to write for humans, not search engines. But in reality, humans aren't even coming to your site. They're bots. And so you're using a robot to augment the content that you're presenting, which is then presented to a bot, which is then transmuted into a snippet in AI for the actual end customer. And it may even, as we move forward, come with extra operations to place an order or to get in touch and leave a voicemail or to schedule a reservation. You know, that certainly is, you know, part of Google's vision. So it has to be part of our marketing methodology to kind of bridge that gap of right for humans and robots, but not like a robot, but using a robot because you got to keep up with your competitors in terms of scale, but also address the intent. It's like an ever, you know, thinning needle that we have to thread through. So what's your position on the information marketplace right now when it comes to copywriting? You know, I respect that digging in of understanding who the model is, who is the audience that you're addressing. But at the end of the day, what's your mindset around how you're crafting that content? Is it, you know, audience specific in terms of like, this is how I talk to people who get to my site? Do I change that for a particular platform that I'm trying to distribute to? What's your approach when it comes to distribution?
It's interesting too, because obviously, you know, I geek out about copyright, and I geek out about, you know, every single word that goes onto a page. But then you're very right in that, you know, if how people are consuming is changing in terms of, you know, if you're hitting the page, they're just using snippets and doing all of that. Like, how does that affect it? So I'm there's I segment in my mind, and you know, remains to be seen if this is correct or not, but I segment things that, for instance, if I'm writing blog posts, I know now that, you know, I could be a little bit more fluid in terms of how I'm writing, just because likely that post gets picked up by AI rather than a human and actually showing a snippet. But my thought process around all of that is I've got to create media differently depending on the platform. So I'm very bullish on video media, for example. So I'm about to dive deep and invest a lot into my own YouTube channel, own video, and I think that's where consumption is actually going. And oh, give me one second. I just sneeze. It's hay fever season for me, so my nose is just going off. But I'm thinking about, you know, the consumption model of people. And for me, if it's copy that I'm writing for a funnel for an ad, I'm still very much of the opinion of this has to be perfect, because that's media that you're pushing onto somebody, right? So if I'm running Meta ads, for example, I know that it's a real human, or generally speaking, a real human that's consuming the copy that goes onto the Meta ad itself. And so I will still take all the time and effort I need to create that copy. If it's a YouTube channel, right, a YouTube video, the way I'm writing the script and the way that I'm presenting the video, it's very human to human. So I'm stripping out everything, but it's still very, very thoughtful, very contained, very much following a flow. Whereas now, if it's for like a blog or something like that, yeah, I'll use a little bit of AI assistance for that. So really depends on the channel that I'm writing for, in you know, just in terms of how careful I am and how much I'm using AI to supplement that.
That's a great segue because was talking with Matt Brooks of Esoteric that I think that the golden age of SEO being Google only. Or Google centric and digital marketing in general, relying so heavily just on Google has come to an end, and cross-channel marketing is having a heyday. So with that comes the difficulty of choosing which channels to leverage and what are the indicators that something a different way might yield more results, whether that's going, you know, and hosting IRL in real life events, using Facebook organically, using, you know, organic on secondary social, or whether it's paid ads, email, you know, physical mailers. So what's your strategy with your clients in understanding the marketplace and understanding where should you be participating? Where, how do you spread that out to have the most impact?
Again, it depends on the business. So I'll talk a little bit about my own business at the moment. moment, and then potentially, you know, for some different business types. But in my own business, the way that I look at it is I've got a matched consumption with where my people are. So I'm going bullish on a couple of key areas. And this is, you know, just to give you context, I never used to be like a content or a social media guy. My thoughts in the past were, can I send cold emails directly to my audience, or can I run ads and actually put my ads directly in front of the right people? I'm still bullish on both of those. Like, I'm still sending cold emails to the market, and I'm seeing, you know, that they're effective. I'm still running ads and seeing that they're effective as well. In fact, both of them have actually turned around and become even more effective over the past year or two. But I also realize fundamentally that the brand element, like, that's so hard to replicate in terms of direct response stuff. Like, the brand, yes, it takes longer. Yes, it's harder to measure. But I've just seen people who have built, you know, smaller channels on YouTube and on Instagram, but have phenomenally big results from it. So I'm definitely going to be using those channels. The flow for me is because I'm such a, you know, business where people need to know who I am before they work with me, right? They need to know what my experiences are, what I've done, what I can help them do, my track record. So I need to show that. And for me, the best way to show that is through YouTube and also social media. So YouTube's the big one for me. I'm investing a lot into that this year. And then Instagram, surprisingly, has been good for me as well. I've only just started on Instagram, but even with like a very small audience, I'm picking up a few hundred views per video, which is very surprising to me. The right views, I'm not sure, but you know, the fact that I can post a reel up and get long-term growth, and every single day it grows and more people see it, that's kind of surprising to me, because it means that the content's sticking around, which for me is, you know, I don't like creating content once and then having it just disappear into the ether, right? And I used to be a big fan of LinkedIn, because you could get more from there, but it just feels like it's so transactional and kind of day by day at the moment. So I'm a little bit bearish on a platform like LinkedIn, but a little bit more bullish on like video content now. But, you know, that's just consulting, right? For my clients, it could be different. Like, if you're in e-com or if you've got a software company, that might not be the right play. Because software, I mean, you know, are people searching for what your software can do? Do you need to be on YouTube? I don't know. So it really does depend on like how your audience wants to consume and where your audience are.
Yeah, I find with software, it is very difficult to maintain like a good video presence, mostly because if you are good at SaaS, your platform itself is changing, should be changing consistently. Like if you have an active product manager pushing, you know, modifications, then, you know, you have to really commit to providing like a new updated version of that video showing that particular feature, because one release and it moves over to another corner, and or maybe that feature gets pushed into another subsection. So that can be very difficult to keep up that medium as a marketing method. Although it does have its own, you know, benefit to have that feature release as the engine of your marketing and like featuring what's come out, but that also requires a really good connection between the developers, your product manager, and the marketing team to align all the way through and consistently be able to do that. If you are, it's a fantastic method. But yeah, there's other plays that are, if you don't have that going for you, you know, for SaaS, there's definitely, you know, a little bit safer to, you know, focus on the content marketing, the written word, you know, the help documents, thinking about, you know, satisfying as many of the customer support queries before they happen with your marketing, you know, being a good provider for your own clients becomes a great marketing channel. So it's not limited there. But I'm curious, when it comes to, you know, physical services or consulting with, you know, somebody doing, you know, installing pools on the service side of things, what's been your recent experience and what's your go-to strategy for marketing mix and approach for service-based businesses?
Yeah, so service-based businesses, I think, you know, I work with a bunch of them. I think they're actually great businesses because they're, generally speaking, unless you've got franchises across the country, you're limited in terms of geography, right? So for example, you typically would only service clients that are less than an hour or 2 hours away from home base, which means that just by nature of the geography, you have less competition. So the strategies that I always go to when it comes to those type of businesses, like pool businesses, lawn mowing, gutter cleaning, whatever the service is, it's a kind of a combination of two. One is direct mail, So just saying, hey, here's the area that I target, here's the area that I service, can I get something in the mailbox of everybody who lives in this area? That by far, and you know, as companies start ignoring that, or as companies have fought, you know, to do purely online, I find that the offline has really started to come around and to perform a lot better. So that's the number one thing that I will do if I own a service business. Do really good mail drops, do them consistently, and you should pick up work from that. The second bit is, because you are limited geographically, ads like, you know, Meta ads, Google ads, for example, they become actually a little bit more effective because you're limiting the area which you're showing your ads. So you're not competing with countrywide companies, limit the area, and then, you know, you don't have to do any other targeting. Just have a good message, have a good offer, go to your local area, tell them that you're you know, someone who's from the local area, and the advertising is actually a lot simpler on that one as well. The content, you might necessarily not want to be doing content as much. I mean, you don't, you know, most people, when they're looking for services, they're probably not trying to do it themselves. So they don't need your video on how you do it themselves. Video is kind of secondary for me, although that could change going forward. But it's literally, you know, if you want more clients and you're in that kind of area, just go direct.
You mentioned it. I'm curious if you've had experience like either working with, you know, a franchisee type business where they've come in and asked for help. What's your thoughts on that particular model? Like, you know, you've got a franchise pizza restaurant or you've got a franchise roofing company. What are the upsides and downsides of if you're trying to be an entrepreneur of looking for a franchise opportunity versus, you know, bootstrapping it yourself?
Okay. My thoughts on this have actually changed a lot over the years. And when I think earlier on, I would have said, look, there's no point franchising. You know, you're literally paying somebody hundreds of thousands of dollars or millions of dollars just for a brand. Having gone through trying to building my own thing, I feel like there is a lot of value in having systems, right? In just having somebody say to you, when a lead comes in, here's the emails you send, here's what you say on the phone, here's how you convert them, here's how you charge them, here's how, like, it just really makes business really easy. The flip side, I'm not fan of or you know, I'm not for or against franchises. I think it really depends on the person that is going through the franchise. If you haven't run a business before, I think it's phenomenal. You're going to make way less mistakes. You're going to take way less time. But the franchise is also something that you have to pay a lot of money for. So that's the issue. And you've got less freedom to learn. You've got less freedom to explore because, you know, if they're a more established franchise, you can't do marketing whatever way you want. So if you buy a McDonald's, and this is an extreme example, if you buy a McDonald's, you're not the one who's going to be controlling the marketing. You're not the one who's going to be controlling, you know, how your brand looks. Somebody else does that, which is good, but it also can be bad, right? So you're never going to be I know very, very wealthy franchise owners who own like 50 franchises. They make a lot of money that way. But in generally speaking, are you going to be making as much as a franchise owner? Probably not. So it's just the balance of, you know, where you want to go, what works for you, what skills you have, what experiences you have. It could be good for some, might not be great for others.
I'm curious, what was the worst mistake that you made, if you're willing to disclose it? And you hopefully learn from that disaster?
Worst mistake. Man, there's just been so many mistakes in business, actually. I think the most expensive one has all to do with hiring. I've probably personally lost hundreds of thousands of dollars in terms of hiring the wrong people, setting them up for failure, setting them up in the wrong way. So I think if there's anyone that's obvious, that would be it. The mistake that I made was hiring the wrong way around in terms of what I needed for tasks at that point. Then, you know, and I don't want to be, because when it comes to, like, I'm going to caveat what I say and have a disclaimer that it was all my fault. I'm not saying, hey, my employees didn't do the right job, because they did the job to the best of their abilities, but their abilities were hampered by how I supported them and helped them with onboarding, helped them to do what they could do. So I'll caveat that by saying that first. But I hired in the wrong fashion. The hires that I had locally, I had a general manager, I had an account manager, and then I had a copywriter. And so it was all still virtual. And between the three roles, you know, we were paying about, I would say, anywhere between $500,000 per year for three roles, right? Very expensive roles. And the way that I look at it now in hindsight, first of all, I hired a general manager because I was burnt out and I just felt, you know, I don't want to be in the day-to-day of the business. So I hired for that role. The recommendation from my network was that, well, if you're going to hire for a general manager, what are you doing next? You want to hire for an account manager. So you're not stuck on phone calls, stuck talking to your clients. The problem with hiring those two roles is that, one, we weren't big enough for a GM. Like, we just did not need a general manager. We just needed me to spend less time working in a few of the things on the business. And so that was a completely wrong hire, and we completely hired the wrong person for the wrong hire. So we hired somebody who would have been great for a bigger business than what we were, but for the business of our size, she just wasn't quite the right fit. And then, you know, there was a few things going on with her personally, and it just wasn't, you know, potentially the right time, right place, and right company. So that was a big lesson. The account manager was more, again, an extension of me just not knowing what we actually needed to hire for. Same kind of thing, very expensive account manager, you know, $100,000 per year, plus costs associated with the hiring. I mean, she was great at what she did. Customers loved her. But the problem was that my business, as I had previously, right, I had a marketing agency, the conversations with the clients was what would give me the ammo to go and write the copy, to run the campaigns. And so having somebody as a layer between that meant I still needed to have the conversations, but it just became, so not only did I have those conversations anyway, I now had somebody tagging along to the conversations for no apparent reason.
Right.
Yeah, so very much a wasted kind of role. And then when I did hire the role that I did need, which was the copywriter, I hired that role. Again, I hired somebody who I thought was senior level, who probably wasn't, you know, so had a senior level salary, but probably wasn't senior level quality. But again, it came back to my fault of not giving her the right training to move her up into that senior kind of skill set. And the way that I should have done it was to hire someone local to me. So she was in another state. I should have hired somebody local to me, got them to come into the office, you know, every single day and sat next to me, because then it's a lot easier to learn how I think about copy, how I approach the copy. And it would have been a lot easier for me to look at what she's doing and said, hey, you're actually not thinking about the right way in this case, or hey, you're thinking about it the right way, but you've got to think it for some more nuance in this area. And that would have been, you know, a 3 to 6 month training process, but she would have been really, really good at the end of it, versus having just somebody sticking around for 6 months, doing something virtually that, you know, every time that she came through, it was so far and away from what I expected, I just end up doing it myself anyway. So, but that was the right role, done the wrong way. And that was, you know, a massive learning experience. So I think a lot of my mistakes, especially the bigger ones that cost me a lot, were to do with hiring, but more so how I approached it and how I managed myself and my staff.
That makes sense. As a kind of wrap up, share, you know, how people can connect with you and kind of, you know, what you're working on now and how, what value are you bringing to the market right now?
Yeah. So at the moment, there's a couple of projects that I'm working on. The one that I'll talk about is Black Belt Consultant. So that's essentially, you know, with AI coming through, the marketing execution stuff is actually so easy now. Like, AI has made it so much more easy. You don't need to go and hire, you know, tech people, designers, things like that. There's ways to do it. But what people are missing is a strategic piece. So if that's the case, you know, if people just don't have the strategy in place and need somebody to come along and go, hey, here's how you target the market, here's what you should be saying, here's what you should be doing, that's how I kind of fit into the picture. So if somebody wants me to have a look at marketing, if you're doing, you know, 25K a month, you want to get to 250K, you know, hit me up. You can probably find me on LinkedIn. You can probably, you know, send me an email. It's will@blackbeltconsulting.co.co. Or, you know, you can find me on Instagram at blackbeltconsultant, I think it is. Yeah, and that's kind of, you know, the thing that I'm working on at the moment.
Fantastic. Thanks so much for your time, Will. It's been a great conversation.
Thanks, Jeremy. Thanks for having me.